Dean Young, a teacher and former state poet laureate of Texas, may sometimes be disenchanted with the poetry biz, but he never loses sight of the importance of the art form either as a writer or reader.
I think one of the reasons we read poetry is to have a kind of active experience of an imagination that's not ours. And I think that's something that opens up possibilities for our own imaginations.
Stay with us to explore the imagination and poetry of Dean Young and discover how his brush with death has affected his work. Today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Since the publication of his first book in 1988, Design with X, Dean Young has been recognized for his modern, surrealistic approach to poetry. Former U.S. Poet Laureate Charles Simic has praised the inventiveness and sheer fun of his work. Young has taught around the country, from the Iowa Writers' Workshop to the University of Texas, where he's the William Livingston Chair of Poetry. The author of more than a dozen collections, Young thought his 2012 book of new and selected poems, Bender, might be his last, because just the year before, he'd had a heart transplant. He's gone on to serve as the 2014 Texas State Poet Laureate, and in December 2015, his collection Shock by Shock was published. We talked at the Kansas City Public Library about the effects of his transplant on his poetry while he was UMKC's 2013 Cockafair Chair Writer in Residence. But first, let's listen to Dean Young read one of his poems.
Red Glove Thrown in Rosebush. If only bodies weren't so beautiful. Even rabbits are made of firecrackers, so tiny they tickle your hand. If only the affirmities, blocked neural pathways, leg braces and bandages didn't make all these bodies look like they're dancing. Breathing will destroy us. Hearts like ninja stars stuck into the sternums of granite Caesars. Should I worry people have stopped saying how skinny and pale I am? Paul may destroy the kitchen, but he's the best cook I know. Seared tuna, pesto risotto, where did he get those tomatoes? What a war must be fought for simplicity. Even the alligator flipped over is soft as an eyelid. Hans, the trapezist, got everyone high on New Year's Eve with a single joint. The girl he was with, a sequin it was impossible not to want to try to catch without a net. Across the bay, fireworks punched luminous bruises in the fog. If only my body wasn't borrowed from dust.
Red Glove Thrown in Rosebush, which originally came from Fall Higher, but it's also in Bender. New and selected poems by Dean Young, and this is New Letters on the Air. And we're at the Kansas City Public Library on a very snowy night. Bender is the book that came out after you had had that heart transplant. But I read that there are very few poems in here that were actually written after the transplant. So most of the poems published so far are with your old heart, which is such an odd thought, your old heart.
Yeah.
Have you seen any kind of difference in your writing?
There is a difference, but it's not because I have a different heart than I did before. It's because I was through a very extreme and difficult physical experience. I was in a hospital bed for 4 months. I was hooked up to a machine for nearly 5 months. I died. You know, a lot of stuff.
You really did? You died? Do you remember?
Yeah. Well, I don't remember it.
Oh, you don't? Okay.
No,
you didn't
no.
have one of those.
I mean,
okay.
One of the things about when they cut you open, they give you a drug that induces amnesia. It helps to remove the trauma from the equation for your healing. So I can't remember it. But, you know, just putting myself back together again and physically, and the main way that my work has changed is there's not as much of it over the last 3 years as there would have been otherwise. I think the experience of putting this collected poems together of making my own sepulcher has been just as traumatic to me in terms of thinking about my work. Because that really put a signpost up. I thought I was done when I was doing it, and that's why it made sense. I thought I was going to die, so did everybody else.
Wow,
when I put that together,
intense.
I thought, okay, yeah. You know, why not a selected poems? You know, and I can make the selections. So now it's like, now what? In many ways, I have the scary opportunity of starting all over again. I've never really had to do that. Anytime previously, by the time a book has come out, I've been so deep into writing what would be the next book that it doesn't bother me. But this is kind of like a big stop sign to me. And hopefully it's only a semicolon, that it's not a full stop. I've been writing poems, though. I've got a lot of new poems that aren't in there.
I wondered if you wouldn't mind reading one of the poems that was written after you had your transplant.
Sure. The new poems just dissolved into this book, which made me happy. One poem I know is absolutely new is the poem that's on the back cover that isn't in the table of contents or in the book. And that was done really late. Michael, my editor at Copper Canyon, as you can imagine, is very, very tolerant of me. This was actually his idea when we were trying to figure out what to do on the back cover. And I hate the whole sort of blurb culture. And, you know, if I couldn't get Shakespeare to blurb the book, why bother?
But you've got some great blurbs.
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah,
you do.
Yeah,
Simic has
I do.
Wonderful things to say about
but
you.
But anyway, I'll read this poem. Street of Sailmakers. It's not easy turning into smoke. Not easy blowing away, because even if the mind is an amaryllis, it still struggles like a moth in a spider web. Because the futility of cathedrals is more beautiful than heaven. When he wasn't hearing what he wanted, Monk, mid-song, would kick his sidemen off stage until it was just him and the damn audience wondering who was next. When my mother died, I was far away and got farther, a rectangular shadow on stilts. Hello, commodious sky, you look high on fumes. How many times must I drop bulbs into a hole and still not know how to be joyous? Years of washing dishes, watching sunsets and insects, and still no easier to see what's written in the dark. Little shiver, I want to preserve you. Little rosebud, I'll try to hold you forever in my mouth.
Street of Sailmakers, that's on the back cover of the collection of new and selected poems by Dean Young in a book called Bender. This is New Letters on the Air at the Kansas City Public Library on the plaza. Well, one of the things that Dean Young has done is he's been teaching for a lot of years, and he actually has a book out called The Art of Recklessness, Poetry as Assertive Force and Contradiction. And I think there's a lot of good information in here about how to approach poetry as a writer. I think it would be useful for someone as a reader, too. Talk a little bit about what the impetus was for putting together this book.
Grey Wolf does a series of the art of something. There's the art of the line. There's the art of attention by Donald Revelle. And the editor is Charlie Baxter, marvelous fiction writer, who at one time was a poet, too, published a really lovely book of poems. And he asked me if I wanted to do a book, and he was thinking that it would be something about surrealism. And so I said, yeah, I'll try it. And I sent Grey Wolf an outline, and they said, do it. It was definitely not going to be a book of essays. If I was going to do a book like that, I was going to do it my way. And it turned out to be sort of one long, something between a rant and a cheerleading about poetry, about aesthetics that I think are generative and welcoming. It's about the importance of poetry, the importance of writing poetry, the importance of MFA programs. There are a lot of strains and arguments that I was pushing back against. One was the overtaught notion that poetry is a matter of craft. I say in the book that we're not making bird cages, we're making birds. It's not a series of skills that you learn. It's a uniquely human endeavor that involves the imagination, which is a uniquely human capacity. I talk about the importance of the imagination. I think that the highest accomplishment of human consciousness is the imagination. And the highest accomplishment of the imagination is empathy. And the more imaginative our culture can become, I think the more empathetic it could become. And the more empathetic it could become, the more peaceful I think we would be, the safer and the better for the planet. So I think if everybody would just get an MFA in creative writing, all our woes would be cured as a planet. I just wanted to talk about some of the literature and aesthetic thinking that I admired most, that was formative to me, that still seems to me to be encouraging and generative.
You address the fact that some people think that there are too many MFA programs, and you're saying that not everybody has to be a teacher, but the idea of everybody trying to write poetry is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, how can there be too many poems in the world? That relates back to this notion that a person can, in fact, survey the whole area, that if somebody's interested in poetry, they know all the good poems that are being written, and they're going to be in charge of it. It's no longer possible for anybody to survey the poetry world in that way. There's just too many of us. Our models are no longer commercial either. Our models are tribal, so that you have little tribes of poets who are banding together and making presses and publishing each other and publishing books. And I think that's all to the good. And one of my big points is that the art cannot be harmed by people trying to do it. Poetry is never harmed by people writing poems. I remember something I don't mention in this book, but when I was teaching at Loyola, my first job, we had a famous poet come in to read, and somebody I respected. He had translated a lot of Zen poetry, if you can imagine. And he said, you know, what have you been doing? I said, I just got done teaching my poetry class. And he said, well, I hope you convinced them of the importance of the art. In fact, I hope you stopped most of them from writing. And it was like, your Zen license should be revoked, dude. I mean, but it was also, it just seemed to me to be so offensive. And it's kind of a generational thing. It used to be people would come in and try to convince us that poetry was so important that we had no business trying to write it. I remember thinking that again and again when I was in school, my professors were basically conveying to me that I had no claim to poetry whatsoever, that I would never touch the knees of the giants. And that's true. I won't. But all I want to do is get into the party. It's not like an elevator you're getting in that says occupancy 35 or something like that, and you're the 40th person. It's not like that at all. You're just trying to add something to the party. And I'm really lucky to teach poetry writing and creative writing, because the poetry world itself, I don't like. I think it's a mess because the egos get involved and the market gets involved. It's a big parade of corpses, but the young really inspire me and fill me with hope.
There's a little passage. I'll get you to read this little bit.
Poetry is no more a thing than fire is. Rather, it is a conversion that reveals itself in the instance of its occasion. Poetry mitigates just as fire does, by witnessing its own necessary recklessness and senses of the sacred, its ability to combat the ancillary, to grow and make everything itself, even as it confronts us with the outcome of its conjunctions, with ash, with death. Let us not forget that the punishment for the God who gave us fire in a hollow reed, already the fire was singing, is eternal evisceration. Aesthetic positions are often drawn towards their own extinction, be it through the impossibilities of their aims or in the ruination brought on by their success.
just a touch of some of the things that are explored in the book, The Art of Recklessness, Poetry is Assertive Force and Contradiction by Dean Young. And he's talking to me today at the Kansas City Public Library on the plaza. This is New Letters on the Air. There was something that you mentioned in The Art of Recklessness. You were quoting Robert Haas, who did what you're doing right now. He came to UMKC as one of the Cockafair Chair visiting writers. You wrote in here, a few years ago, Robert Haas said to me, "I still don't know what I'm doing," at which point it occurred to me that not knowing what we're doing is obviously the thing to do. Talk a little bit about that.
A way to think about poetry is that it's a blend of the conscious mind and the unconscious mind. Or another word to use for the unconscious mind is the imagination. Will and imagination, or intention and imagination. And for me, art, not only my own but other people's art, it seems to have absolutely this vital ingredient of imagination, of the unconscious. And the thing about the imagination and the unconscious is it cannot be known. Definitionally, it's that thing that can't be intended, that can't be rationally explained. It's everything that gives us inklings that maybe we're not just mortal spindrift. Maybe there's something else to these passing moments of radioactive decay. And because that vital ingredient is something that we can never know, it seems to me to be utterly important. And so what we want to do as artists is get better at doing what we don't know how to do. I base my whole pedagogy on that, and that's one of the things that that book talks about. I love to use the word pedagogy. Some part of me always laughs out loud whenever it hears me say that word. Like, who are you kidding? So I think that, you know, how do you educate the imagination? That's a good question, isn't it?
Well, you know what else I like about the whole idea of that? It gives you the license to be fearless, just to do it and not feel like you have to know what you're doing right off the bat, to explore.
Yeah, and remember that you weren't put on this earth to explain yourself.
It's a good way to put it. There's another poem that I would just love to hear you read. It's called Lives of the Poets.
It's kind of longish. To you, Walt Whitman has probably always been dead. But to me, he died just yesterday, after many pages. His body a mess, large portions nearly empty, although it was the other parts filled with masses beyond the understanding of the 19th century that prevented him from becoming a wind instrument or a kite. But sometimes he's still a whole orchestra unto himself, as if every word he ever wrote was being said simultaneously, although a little muffled, maybe just a squirrel landing on the roof of another world, or a vacuum cleaner hose shifting among the overcoats of another world, because the life of a poet is always passing from one world to another, dream to dream, tissue through tissue, red stain upon the beach. My friend's solution is to read me another version of Paradise over the phone. At first, the gods lie around slurping the fruits of the tree of knowledge until they're full. But because this is paradise, they're never full. But what they get is stupefied with the silk and slither of it, the wet going down. Oh, how they long to click some ammo in, wreck a bicycle. Anything but every greasy secret unhinged, every outburst musical as if all singing didn't come from singeing. So finally, they grow intolerable to themselves. They start to stink and shun each other until finally, because this is paradise, it's finally all the time. Finally, they fall like frostbit peaches back into the mud, the furnace, into the lucky ones, the bodies of caterpillars who spin from themselves the finest filaments. It's hard to believe how strong silk is, considering it comes from a bug's butt. And often it's quite instructive to try ripping some parachute, some net, some flouncy party dress, to try and break these ties that bind us, oh my Lord, impossible. My friend has almost nothing to say about the woman he loves who stole his furniture. Nothing about the singing children you can't avoid this time of year. I hate singing children. As if anything deserves to be so unugly. As if we all aren't on one end or another of the spear. Ants climbing over ants. Geese wading through frozen fields. My friend has even less to say about Walt Whitman. Odic force or cosmic wanker. Almost everything he revised he made worse. Certainly his family was a handful. Mom suffered from rheumatism of the leg, variously diagnosed as vaporous ejectum, crunching womb, salt in the clusters. Then she died, still unable to punctuate sensibly. And Eddie, retarded, mostly confined younger brother, came to resemble the flyleaf portraits of the bard more than he did himself those waning years. Eddie, however, responded only to sweets. Let into his rooms those waning years, you'd be greeted by the cosmos enveloped in white sheets, unable to get up from the piles of paper he forbade his housekeeper, who would have to sue for back wages, to touch. Little wound, what is it you wish to say? You think you'll recover, but you'll never recover. I was drunk when I got here. I plan on being drunk when I leave.
Very nicely done. I think that speaks to the fact that the life of the poet is always passing from one world to another. That's the poem Lives of the Poets from the collection New and Selected Poems by Dean Young called Bender, and this is New Letters on the Air. You like to use humor in your poetry. You're not afraid of that at all, are you?
No, I'm not, but humor isn't something I use. It's just something that happens, and I think one of the things that makes things funny is that there's a shift in context. I was once asked after a reading by somebody who said, "Why are your poems so funny?" And I said, because life is brief, we often don't get what we want, and then we die.
Oh.
And everybody laughed. And why is that? That doesn't seem like a very big joke to me. It seems kind of terrible.
It's because it is so true.
Right. And yeah. And we're often in a context where we don't expect the truth. So I think that's one of the reasons why it seems my poems are funny. When I'm writing, I'm not aware of, oh, here's a funny bit to fit in. It just seems to be part of the texture of being and thinking. And one of the things that I am interested in my work, consciously so, is trying to capture the strange and incongruous texture of experience, of what it's like to be alive. And as far as I can tell, what being alive is about is a lot of mood swings. it's never one thing for a very long time. If there's anything original about my work, it's that I've tried to copy a lot of different poets, and I've done a very bad job of it. My originality is based upon my inability to copy well. But, you know, the same way as going to an art museum stretches our minds, that engaging in an art as a appreciator is still a collaborative project. It's still a way of energizing that part of the mind. I think we've all had experiences with music or poetry or painting or sculpture or dance where we've been profoundly affected by something, but we don't know why. And I think that's good for us as human beings. I just think it's a good thing that happens, and it causes us to grow. The best thing anybody's ever said to me about anything that I've ever written is that it makes them want to write.
Yeah. This is changing gears altogether. But I thought I might have you read the title poem of the book that was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize back in 2006, I believe. It's called Elegy on Toy Piano.
The elegy is an elegy for Kenneth Koch, who I was lucky enough to be friends with. I felt like I needed to write this elegy, but I also felt incredibly dwarfed by the task. And Kenneth is a great poet, and his accomplishment has really contributed something to poetry, and he really meant a lot to me. So I knew I had to do this, and I decided that I would try to go small because there was no way I could make it big enough so that it would feel right to me. So at the time, it seemed like a kind of poem that I'd never written before. Elegy on Toy Piano. You don't need a pony to connect you to the unseeable, or an airplane to connect you to the sky. Necessary it is to die if you are a living thing, which you have no choice about. Necessary it is to love to live, and there are many manuals, but in all important ways, one is on one's own. You need not cut off your hand, no need to eat a bouquet. Your head becomes a peach pit, your tongue a honeycomb. Necessary it is to live to love, to charge into the burning tower, then charge back out, and necessary it is to die. Even for the grass, even for the pony connecting you to what can't be grasped. The injured gazelle falls behind the herd, one more last enjambment. Because of the sores in his mouth, the great poet struggles with the dumpling. His work has enlarged the world, but the world is about to stop including him. He is the tower the world runs out of. When something becomes ash, there's nothing you can do to turn it back. About this, even diamonds do not lie.
That's lovely.
Thanks.
That's Elegy on Toy Piano, the title poem of the book by the same name, which that poem is included in the new and selected poems by Dean Young called Bender. And that's a good way to end, I think, tonight. Thank you very much for coming out. And Dean Young, thank you very much for doing this.
It was a pleasure.
Dean Young at the Kansas City Public Library as UMKC's 2013 Cockafair Chair Writer-in-Residence. In late 2015, Copper Canyon Press also published his book, Shock by Shock, all new works written after his heart transplant. For links, go to newletters.org. There you can also sign up for our free weekly podcast or find us on iTunes. Follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, or Twitter at New Letters Radio. A production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Today's show was produced with Jamie Walsh, Ross Steinmetz, and Stephanie Hughes. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.